Hi, ladies and gentlemen. It is great to have you here. We are 100% excited to be back for another incredible episode. So thank you for pulling a chair up to the table and joining us for the meeting of Unknowing Minds. As always, my name is Matt Eshe, the head cross country associate head track and field coach at UAB. It is incredible to have you here. Thank you for taking hours, 70 minutes out of your day to listen to us talk, discuss, debate, and learn from some of the greatest coaches that this sport has to offer, and maybe hopefully put some stuff up there that, you know, you're trying to figure out, you're trying to, you know, you ponder a little bit, and we don't always expect that you agree with us, but at the same time, hopefully it's something that we can provide some incredible conversation and some incredible insightfulness. We believe it's insightful, whether you guys do or not, but hopefully you do. Hopefully along with that same exact thing. So without further ado, go ahead, put another cup of coffee or pour another cup of coffee, get some water, go ahead and get board, or if you really want to, go ahead and pop a top or put a little extra on ice. This one's going to be a good one. We've been excited for it. You've already seen his picture on the Instagram, on the Twitter, whatever the case might be. We're going to get to him in just a second here. But as always, real quick before we start, thank you for making us a top 40 running podcast in the country. We couldn't do it without our loyal listeners. So without further ado, we'll start out over in Nevada, Mr. Scott Williamson. Scott, how you doing, sir?
Doing well, doing well. I know we had some great weather today, and we're holding things up. I'm sure the country's got a little bit of us on our mind right now, but hopefully they'll have some answers for everybody soon. But other than that, we're doing pretty good.
Yeah, we're not singing Georgia on our mind right now. I think we're all singing Nevada on our mind. I don't know. It sounds like a good country song, though. I'll tell you that much. We're going to switch countries back to the switch parts of the country to the Midwest. We got Mr. Mike Erb up in Indiana. Mike, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. Don't want to get too into what Scott was talking about, but I went to bed last night feeling one way and woke up feeling a little different. I'll just say that. And so it's been a good day. So far, so good.
Understandable. Questions about that. We'll stay up there in the Midwest. No questions about it. The gentleman who takes Wednesdays off, even though he works as hard and gets a nice little glow going on that bald head of his, Mr. John Bell up at SLU. John, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, we're doing well. It's been a day, even though it was my day off, but it's been a day. Weather must be fantastic in Nevada. They don't know. They must not be counting out. Enjoying the weather.
They're all up at Lake Tahoe.
I don't blame them.
I don't blame them either, tell you that much. Let's go all the way down a little bit, as far south as you can go without grabbing probably can grab a 3-iron and hit it over the border a little bit, but all the way down there in the Rio Grande Valley, Mr. Darren Flowers, how you doing, man? Oh, man, see, the joy of technology is he's on mute right now, so he can't realize it. Let's get him back here in a second. See if he flips. No, we can't hear him yet. All right, let's go back up to the – yep, he's going to come back. He's on. When we get him, we'll get him back. But we'll go up to the north, the southeast a little bit in VCU. Mr. Tom Sage. Tom, how we doing? Look, you've got a nice little rocker, a chair.
Yep, doing well. Sitting in the baby's room at my sister-in-law's house.
I know you got about 10 days or so before I move to?
Yeah, roughly 12, it looks like.
Man, you're getting there. It's
not
coming.
That you're counting.
Nope, just 12.
Oh man, and he's back. Let's just double check and see if the audio is back. Darren, are we there? Man, 0-2. He's got nope. All right, we're gonna dive into it. He'll come back. We know we will for a little bit. But tonight, I'm not sure. I've looked through this gentleman's bio, and we are absolutely blessed to have the Hall of Famer Lance Harder on. And I think you can read through the bio, be incredible. Everything from an 8-time National Coach of the Year, 39-time SEC Coach of the Year. He's been a head coach of Team USA in 1999, the World Championships. I can go on for a long time and some of the most incredible things. I know they won, 14 national titles at Cal Poly. We'll get into that a little bit, but it is Coach Harder. It is incredible. It is grateful. We are, it's our pleasure to have you on. So thanks for taking time, because I know you're talking, you're doing Zooms, you're doing everything. Thanks for being here.
Hey, I'm looking forward to it. This is something that, it's a lot of fun, and I hope that, what I have been able to contribute will be positive to all those that listen.
Oh, I appreciate that. I have no doubt about this. Unfortunately, last week we were about to get into it, and then we realized we had Coach Quintana on from Oregon State, and all of a sudden we realized, there's a lot of things to talk about, and everything's kind of calmed down other than the election, which, you know what, we aren't going to get into politics. It's something that we definitely decided on this podcast we never would do. But so, Coach, let's start. Let's just jump right into it. I know you're from California. I know you've got your roots there in that way. But how does the California kid go to Texas Tech? I mean, how do you get over there that way? Because the grapevine, you love to longboard, you love to hit the surf a little bit. But how do you end up? How'd you, and even anything, how did you end up running? Because longboarding and, you know, surfing is something that most California kids would do instead of going run.
I was real fortunate. I was we moved to San Francisco, a place called Pacifica. It's right on the water, and I took up surfing when I was 12 years old and started getting fairly good at it. And part of the process with the group of guys that I surfed with, they used to run a lot on the beach to, you know, kind of stay in shape. And one of the individuals identified myself as fairly smooth runner and said, hey, you ought to try out for the cross country team. So when I became a freshman in the high school, I went out for cross country, and that kind of launched my running career. Had some success, and then my senior year, my dad got a job transfer from basically San Francisco Bay Area to Denver, Colorado. And when we arrived in Denver, no one knew anything about running, didn't know anything about altitude. It was like going to Mars. And so, you know, I tried to take the training that I became adapted to in California to Colorado, and that worked backwards real quickly. So eventually I became acclimatized to the altitude. There wasn't a lot of people to run with because running just was not trendy at the time. But there was a guy named Frank Shorter that was there going to school, and he and I were able to hook up, you know, occasionally on workouts, where I quickly realized he was doing 30-mile runs on Sunday. I quickly realized that I was going to more focus on the middle distances. but things went really well, and I was the first person in my family history to ever go to college. Wow. It was never a thought prior to that. I was one of the few guys in the school that was very academically oriented, but it had a ag section as well. And so I was working on carpentry classes as well as taking physics and calculus. So I was one of the hybrids, I guess, of the high school. Was very fortunate to have some visibility, and got a lot of job or scholarship offers to go to college. And my parents definitely didn't have the resources to ever help assist or pay my way through college by any means. I have three younger brothers. And so Texas Tech offered the most, and I wanted to definitely get out of the snow country, and went to Lubbock, Texas. There was a stable of California guys that I had run against prior, and so kind of knew some of those people, and went there. That was probably one of the mistakes I made in my life. I made many, but that was one of the first ones, because a guy named Joe Vigil had just become the track coach at Adams State College in Alamosa, Colorado. Yep. I had visited Adams State and realized it just didn't seem to have everything that some of these other major universities had. So ended up going to Texas Tech, basically trained myself with my teammates because our coaching was a debacle. Had, you know, some highlights here and there, but it was definitely not real productive. Many people say that the best view of Lubbock, Texas is in the rearview mirror. So 4 years
before,
I graduated, got out as quick as I could. And fortunately, I had real good grades, real good test scores, and I had an opportunity to return to Colorado and do my master's degree work at Colorado State University. They were doing a lot of innovative things in the physical education program. And one of them was the Nautilus weight training machines were devised there. And we did the validity testing of the Nautilus series. We did some unique studies while I was there. There was 30 of us that were brought in this kind of high turbo research program and so on. And it was very, very, very challenging. And I then volunteered with a guy named Del Hessel, who was the track coach at Colorado State, and spent 2 years there, went through the two-year program. I was one of the few guys that actually graduated. My aspirations at 22 years old was, hey, I was ready to coach in college. Most ADs were smart enough to realize I was way too young. So I took a high school job back at Southeast Denver, and it was a brand new high school called Smoky Hill.
Okay.
And was able to develop a program there. Actually, I was 23 years old when I started, and at 29, I accepted the job at Cal Poly SLO. So, you know, it was some really great, rewarding opportunities to coach in high school, to be the director of cross country and track and field in a brand new school that had a lot of resources. We had only freshmen, sophomores to start, and then we added a class each year. So a few years later, I had an opportunity to interview at SLO, and I was really torn about the idea of leaving the high school ranks. We had great depth, great teams. So on one weekend, we split our team in track to three different invitationals, and just so happened that we won all three meets. And so the Colorado Activities Association was going to make a rule from then on that you couldn't split your team. You had to only go to one competition. And in high schools, a lot of times the limitation is three entries per event, so on and so forth. And we had 170 guys out for track and over 100 girls in a relatively, you know, school of only 2,000. I think that convinced me it was time to move on. And then was fortunate enough that I was able to get a physical education coaching position at Cal Poly SLO. Yeah. And with the idea that I would focus on the women's side. Steve Miller at the time later became the director of sports marketing for the Nike Corporation, was the male counterpart. And so the two of us, coached track and field. So you mentioned Louis Quintana. During my stay of 11 years at Cal Poly, almost 11 years, a good friend of mine was the high school coach at a neighboring high school called Arroyo Grande. And he had this young guy that was a real star. And he said, Lance, I need some help in training him. And so we collaborated on Sundays to devise a training scheme for this outstanding individual. And it turned out to be a young man named Louis Quintana. So Louis had great success as a prep and obviously as a collegian. And, I tried to attract him to come to Arkansas, but, he had an opportunity to go to Villanova and have a great career. So my roots with Louis go way, way back.
They go extremely far back. So when you get – so I actually found this interesting. I did some reading and stuff, but I love the story on this. So you get to Cal Poly, SLO, and then you're being interviewed for the job at Arkansas. Okay. Fascinating. So I'll let you tell this because this is absolutely fascinating in my mind.
Well, I was very fortunate that at Cal Poly, the program was not very competitive, partly because of the coaching at the time, partly because the resources were so, so limited that, it took a lot of hard work not only teaching, I was hired to be teaching five classes a semester. And then actually at the time they did a quarter system, and then coach on the side. I actually had two separate paychecks, one for coaching and one for teaching. No paid coaches, assistant coaches. So basically you were a solo act.
How many kids did you have?
We would have probably up to 50 at a time. So recruiting to San Luis Obispo is one of the simplest formulas there is. It's absolutely gorgeous. The facilities at the time were very inadequate, but the setting was so ideal. Great education, great location, exactly midway between LA and San Francisco. So we stayed primarily in state, worked up and down the coast, and those that were not either good enough or felt they weren't good enough to go to USC or UCLA or Cal Berkeley, and then obviously Stanford gets the pick of the litter. A lot of these California kids just needed an opportunity. And so my recruiting was, because my budget was so limited, my budget for equipment, travel was $10,100. And I had three scholarships. So, and that's one thing that didn't change. They were very consistent. The first year was there, the year I left, the budget stayed the same. So, in fact, I would go back and gripe and say, hey, you guys got to help me out. I need more money. And they said, well, you're winning already. So why do you need more money? Why do you need more scholarships? I was raising about $35,000 a year in some form or fashion. So I was a full-time fundraiser. I stalked different people that had interest in and the passion of track and field to come join me and be an assistant coach, but always in a volunteer position. Fred Harvey, who's the head coach at University of Arizona, Dave Cinelli, who's the head coach of Virginia Tech. They're just two of the people that came in, basically sacrificed their lives because we weren't giving them any money, and they found part-time employment or whatever to make ends meet. Dave Cinelli actually lived in our track shed and slept on top of the pole vault pits and stayed there for a good 6 months until our administration found out that he was living there. And so we had to move out. But, you know, there was no money. It was just hard work and a lot of passion to try to get that program going. So, you know, a lot of times they talk about Arkansas. Well, we really paid our dues at SLO because there were really, really hard times. And I was audited by the IRS five times because so many times when the budget ran out of money, basically it was put on credit cards. And my wife at the time was tolerant enough for it, but eventually she got tired of it. So, you know, we parted our ways eventually. But anyway, it was some great years, and we were able to attract a lot of kids that, again, just had great passion and desire of wanting to be good. Maybe, if anything, a little bit of vengeance to try to see if they had an opportunity down the road that they could maybe take advantage of some of their counterparts that, you know, had beaten them repetitively in the high school ranks. And so my recruiting was pretty much the tier under what the Division I schools were picking off. And then eventually we had some success. 2 years later, we won the national Division II title. We never competed indoors for a national title. I'm certain that we could have been very, very competitive. But we ended up winning 14 national championships between cross country and outdoor track, which attracted some other Olympic caliber athletes to come join us. Karen Smith, one of the greatest javelin throwers that America's ever had. She was one of our athletes. A British athlete named Tina Colebrook came and joined us. And she was a girl that was very competitive years prior, kind of lost her way and wanted to restart. She came in and ended up running real fast and setting some collegiate records. So we were kind of a little bit of a dynamo going. My next to last year, the rules were in Division II that if you had people in the top three placement in Division II, you could advance to Division I. So one year we scored a lot of points in Division II. I had a very limited budget, tapped the credit cards again, and the national championships were in at BYU in Utah. And so we took part of our team from Cal Poly and got a chance to compete at the Division I level. All said and done, we were second in the meet. They wouldn't let us score as a team. And then, kind of like what happened in Colorado, they made a rule quick after that, no more Division II kids advancing to Division I. So wow. I kind of knew then, you know, in the next few years, it was time to leave. And had turned down some great jobs, University of Southern California, UCLA, Cal Berkeley, quite a few others that I interviewed on the phone or was solicited on the phone to leave SLO. But for one reason or another, for me or my family, it just wasn't optimal. So we had, I think we interviewed about 13 times. University of Tennessee was one of the finals. And then I was at a national USA track and field cross country championships and had some elite athletes there in the junior division, senior division. And a young lady came over that was the track coach at University of Arkansas named Bev Lewis. And Bev said, "Hey, would you join me for dinner? I'd like to talk with you." And I said, "Heavens, a free meal. We'll definitely talk as long as
please take it." Yep.
So we sat down and chatted, and she said, "I'm going to give up the coaching responsibilities at Arkansas because I've been, you know, hired as the new women's athletic director at Arkansas, and I'd like you to come in and take over the Arkansas women's track program and be a compliment to Coach Mack." And I've been here 31 years.
Didn't you guys, am I right? Didn't you guys jump conferences the day you arrived in Fayetteville?
Yes, that was heartbreaking. In the interview process, I said, "Okay, now we're going to stay in the Southwest Conference because there was rumors about the SEC." And Bev assured me, "Yeah, that's just rumors. We're staying in the SWC." And I had already kind of figured out that I think we could walk in pretty quickly and have our way with the SWC. So when we moved in, literally, I drove in behind the moving truck and she pulled in right beside me. And we're getting ready to unload the moving truck. And she goes, "Lance," and I'm thinking, "Boy, this is great. The athletic director, you know, comes in on a Sunday morning to welcome us to Arkansas and so on." And she just gets out of her car, walks up and goes, "Hey, was it, you know, how are you doing?" Kind of real short, small talk. And then she goes, "Do you have a tie?" And I said, "A tie? What do you need a tie for?" And I said, "There's a tie in that truck." And she goes, "Well, you need to find it because you need to be in the press conference tomorrow. We're moving to the SEC." And I said, "You know, that's a really bad idea because those people, they'll cut your throat. Those people are competitive. And I think you really made a mistake." But she goes, "Well, that wasn't my decision. But Frank Broyles and our president at the time, Dan Ferriter, said, hey, this is a great opportunity." And we went in and listened to the SEC spiel and so on and so forth. And immediately I thought, man, I have to do some recruiting really fast because otherwise we're going to get buried.
So you had a lot of success. I mean, you've had incredible success at the high school level. I think any high school coach that listens to that is probably going to rewind it and go, you had 170 kids and you win three meets, three separate meets. Like, you've got to be kidding. But you had incredible success. at Smoky Hill, you Cal Poly, you get 14 national titles. So then you get to Arkansas and you have success. You've had incredible success. No questions about that. How has the philosophy changed, even going from a D2 to, I mean, you had some incredible athletes, so it's almost you guys are running at a D1 level. Really, we're really close to that D1 level.
In fact, I was really blessed to have some great people around me, be it at Cal Poly or be it at Arkansas. I've always been lucky enough to find people that complement my weaknesses. So as far as coaching goes, I've been really blessed to have great assistant coaches, some that are unpaid, and now the people that I have are very well paid. So that's been a blessing by our administration to surround me with very capable people.
I'm curious what happened at that dinner with Arkansas. You turned down 13 jobs at some pretty amazing places. What the heck did they tell you at Arkansas that said I'm in?
You know, it's interesting. When I flew in here with my wife at the time, we were only here for about 24 hours. So we shot in from, it was about mid-April, and the weather was perfect. You know, the trees and hills and so on reminded me a lot of Northern California, where I was originally from. The passion and support was very visible and very electric. And then obviously having Coach Mack here, sitting down with him and saying, hey, obviously you're doing a great job on the men's side. Can we do this on the women's side? And he was 100% supportive and always encouraging. In fact, I have some great stories about Coach Mack, but it just seemed like a natural. And as we flew out of Fayetteville, which at the time was a very small little community, my wife looked at me and said, you know, if we don't take this job, we're never going to leave. And you're going to be miserable at SLO because you're just racking your brain and our credit cards trying to keep this thing going. Because it literally became a monster on its own. And then I, you know, spoke with my dad, and my dad said, you know, you won 14 national titles. What else are you going to do?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you go to Division I and see what you can handle? And again, the rest of his history.
Sure.
How has the philosophy changed? It's got to be tweaked a little bit, but how's the philosophy changed ever since you've gotten from, you know, from Cal Poly then to Arkansas and even the 30 years? What did you start with and what have you gone to now?
Well, I think one of the things when we first started, it was learned by doing. I mean, we were flying by the seat of our pants. I had two graduate assistants. I had no paid full-time assistant coaches. That's something that Bev felt she could eventually put together. I coached all the events when I first got here, and then eventually was able to convince her to convert one of the graduate assistants to being able to bring in an assistant coach full time. And that helped a lot. And then we were able, as we became more and more competitive in the SEC, cross country didn't take long to be able to get some success there. But track, I mean, we were always chasing the LSUs and Floridas and so on. We definitely had our hands full. I knew I had to have a staff that was capable of battling my peers at the time and their staffs, and that we had to escalate recruiting not only nationally, but probably also touch internationally. And that was an evolution that took a little bit of time. And fortunately, we were able to, put it together. And then I was blessed to have Lonnie Green, which really took a huge step up for us in the jumps and sprints and hurdles. And then we were at the conference championships, and Bev Lewis has always been a track fan, and she would come to some of our meets, especially the championship meets. And we were at LSU, and we were having a great meet, and it was a battle down to the mile relay, and we ended up losing the meet by 2 points. And she came to me and said, "Okay, what do you got to do to you know, take the next step?" I said, "We need to get rid of this graduate assistant position, get a full timer." And that's when I was able to bring Brian Compton on board.
Yep.
And then we just kind of took off. And then when Lonnie took the opportunity at Purdue to become the director of track and field there, one of our former graduate assistants was a guy named Chris Johnson. And so we groomed Chris. He went to Penn State, had great success. And then when Lonnie had the opportunity, I said, "Well, I'm going to go after Chris Johnson." Went to our athletic director and said, "Hey, if we're going to continue to win, I need this guy." And he said, "Is he going to be expensive?" And I said, "Yeah, he's going to be very expensive." And he said, "Go get him." And again, that was one of the blessings that I've had with our various administrations, is they've always been very supportive at trying to, you know, continue to keep us going at a very high level.
You mentioned when you were out in California, your budget didn't change, but you know, you've been through various administrations now. How do you approach that topic with them?
Well, you know, it's interesting because with COVID, if you have a Power Five budget, which ours is very, very lucrative, well over $100 million, and football gets stymied, and TV revenue and basketball gets stymied, all of a sudden now you're trying to figure out how to save $30-40 million. You know, as I told my leadership, "Hey, you know, we can trim down some things here and there or sacrifice various things, because believe me, as long as we don't get down to $10,100, I'm in great shape. We can stay competitive." And my wife now, I mean, she definitely keeps those credit cards under control. So, they've been very supportive, and where we can give back, we've done so in various phases of our budget. At the same time, they don't want, their number one priority is the athlete feels no difference that we're going through COVID as we would any other year. So that's been a blessing. I have taken a pay cut, as many people have in our department, and that's, you know, kind of nationally an escape valve that a lot of us have had to accept to help contribute to keep this thing going.
It's not easy to be able to keep this thing going no matter what you're doing. You mentioned some incredible coaches, Lonnie and Chris. You've got a phenomenal staff there as well right now. Were there characteristics when you're talking to coaches and talking to other people and doing the research on them that you're like, "These are the 3-4 things that I need for these kind of coaches"?
Very much so. Philosophically, that, you know, we're a united front. One of the things that I, you know, no matter if it's a distance runner or a sprinter or a pole vaulter, you know, philosophically, we're all on the same page. We're all, you know, we realize a formula that works for us at Arkansas might not work at some other universities, but with our philosophy overall as a team and then as a coaching staff, we feel if all three of us do our job most effectively, and then we bring that three-prong approach together, it makes us for a pretty lethal combination. And so far, you know, they're as big a fans of cross country as anyone, yet, you know, they don't spend that much time with those kids because they're taking care of their event areas. But I always try to touch, as the head coach, on every area to make sure that, you know, there's open communication and there's encouragement. When we won the national title indoors in Birmingham, we were very fortunate that we were able to, you know, get ahead of Southern Cal. But right before the 3000, the next to last event, I happened to have two entries in it, Taylor Werner and Lauren Gregory, as I'm working around the stadium to get to them, to let them know that we just scored 21 points in the pole vault, which now jettisoned into that if we scored a couple points in the three and held our own in the mile relay, that there was a possibility of winning it. And by the time I got to them, I passed our little hurdler. There's a, you know, a freshman at the time. And she said, "Coach, it's all taken care of." And it was like,
"You're like what?
You're a freshman hurdler." So
yeah.
By the time I got to Taylor and Lauren, I said, "Hey, this is what's going on." And they said, "Coach, we already know. Our hurdler just told us what's going on." And they
she
briefed us what we need to take care of. So there was that type of unity that, you know, they just wouldn't let each other down, and they were all in it collectively. And when we were able to secure the win, each and every one of those people was overjoyed because it was such a collective event. And the same thing happened in outdoors at Texas when Taylor Werner stepped up and grabbed second place in the 5,000 after doubling from the 10 to get us ready where we could hold our own in the mile relay. So, you know, it's a culture that I think has become self-perpetuating. And the same thing holds true in cross country. You know, we were fortunate that the SEC televised our conference championships live. You know, our track team was glued to their televisions. And by the time we flew home that afternoon and I went to track practice, those kids were all just so giddy about the idea that, you know, Arkansas had won. So everybody has a vested interest in whatever the competition may be.
That's, I mean, without question, that's the best way that things can go. You've got you've got the team involved. You've got the coaches involved. Everybody's listening to the same rhetoric, speaking the same rhetoric. It doesn't matter if you're recruiting tech, you know, you hit a recruiting aspect to it and go, "Hey, here's our message here." And you can walk out the door and your current coach, you go, "Boom, this is the message." And you don't even flinch on what's going on. And
exactly.
The kids absolutely buy into it.
Yep. There's no doubt about it. And I think that's one thing that, you know, has evolved in my coaching career here at Arkansas is that we've become much, much more united, even though we are in separate venues in training and separate focuses. One of the things that I got chastised about early on a lot by my SEC peers is the idea of dividing your team and sending them in different directions. I've always promised the athletes that we're going to take you to the most optimal opportunity for you to be successful. So Stanford is a beautiful place to run for distance runners. It's not a good place for the sprints, and it's proven time and time again not to be.
Yes.
So why penalize our sprinters because we chose to take the crew to Stanford? The same thing holds true for pole vaulters. There are certain places that are absolutely ideal to pole vault at. Mount SAC, I've always been a great fan of the Mount SAC relays for eons, and great distance carnival. Can have great sprints, terrible place to pole vault. Now with their new super facility that just got done, to Vince Bryan to bring the vaulters out to California. But the idea is that we want to make sure that each and every kid feels that they have an optimal opportunity to perform at the top level.
So I'm curious, Coach, you know, you've obviously built a very well-rounded program there. And I think, you know, when you look at building a program, I'm of the same philosophy that I feel like, if you can build a strong overall program with cross country and the various events, it actually feeds into itself. And, you know, you see a lot of teams that kind of just, okay, I'm going to go one way, and that may be budgetary, you know, or just what they can be successful at where they're at. But I want to get your take on where you started to think, okay, I really need to make this thing an entire track program in order to really have long sustained success.
Well, I think part of it was when I interviewed with Bev Lewis, that was part of her philosophy at Arkansas. And Coach Mack, you know, was winning triple crowns right and left and making it look like it was nothing but an easy walk through the park. So I think the environment that we inherited was, hey, we're going to have to emulate some of what the men are doing because obviously it's working. And that was kind of if there's something that has evolved in the sport, which I feel is somewhat maybe potentially a downfall, is we've become very fractionalized. We have programs that are training for cross country 9 months a year, and then they have a 3 month season. We also have sprint programs that are only sprint programs, and they throw a token cross country team out there, but there is no finances involved as far as scholarships and so on.
Yep.
Part of that is mandated by location. You know, LSU always says it's hard to get distance runners to come to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in the fall and spring. And it's a great place to recruit sprinters. Well, you got to go with your natural strengths. One of the things that we're fortunate at Arkansas is we have a relatively temperate climate and we have a phenomenal indoor facility. Yep. So we can, you know, go from event to event across the board. Philosophically, we've cut back financially in the throws because in the SEC, throwers become so expensive to be competitive that we can take some of those monies and put them more into the sprints, hurdles, or jumps, or the distances, and get more bang for our buck. So efficiently and effectively, we take that very much into account. And then another thing philosophically, we're always recruiting 2 years ahead. So we're building the team. And obviously we get some things at the last minute that might change an emphasis one way or the other. Yeah. Because, you know, all of a sudden another 14-6 pole vaulter shows up and is available and wants to transfer in. Well, then we're crazy not to keep, you know, putting those types of athletes in Brian's hands. Same thing with Chris and then obviously in the distances as well. This year, for example, we're going to sign a phenomenal freshman distance class that just happened to work out. Maybe a little bit at the sacrifice of the sprints and the jumps this year, but it just happened to be one of those years where we were kind of the flavor of the month, and we were able to convince four, you know, very talented individuals to come join us, knowing also that we're going to graduate three heavy duty seniors this year. So we made a little bit of swap, leaned into some of the other guys' monies, but I think, you know, the end result is going to be, we're still going to be competitive across the board, and we're going to try to, you know, keep our weapons where they are weapons.
And I guess that's the benefit of hiring assistant coaches that are on the same page with you as far as philosophically where the program's headed.
Yeah, it's very much a give and take situation. We've never had a knockdown drag out or an elevated conversation thus far. It's a matter of, hey, I've got this girl, she can do the X, Y, and Z for us. Well, I have this girl, she can only do X, and maybe somebody else can do Y. Hey, we got to go with the most bang for our buck. And again, it's a give and take, but we all know collectively we're trying to win as a team.
Coach, I had a question kind of regarding culture and stuff. You know, you guys are a women's only program, but you know, obviously have a very successful men's team in Arkansas as well. You know, here in Nevada, we're a women's only and there's not a men's team. And, you know, a lot of the, the young women on our team, they talk about missing, you know, having, you know, the men's team around and how that, you know, kind of helps and pushes them. And I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, the culture and if there is a lot of, you know, I'm assuming there's a lot of interaction and stuff between the two programs, but you know, kind of how it's been building a culture for just a women's only program.
Well, the one thing that we were very fortunate of, Coach Mac, you know, had it really rolling on the men's side. And so we tried to emulate that as much as possible. And a lot of those guys, you know, years ago when we first came, were really, really good about encouraging the women's team as it was evolving and developing into a program that was competitive in the conference as well as the national level. So we were very fortunate with that. But the one thing I keep selling to my administration, because, you know, as athletic directors, as they look across the board, the trend is you always have a director of track and field that oversees both programs. And what I tell my athletic director, if you're in the most competitive class that's going to make you or break you to get your degree, do you want to be in a class of 140? Or do you want to be a class of 50? And he said, well, and everybody says, you know, we want to get as close to one-on-one as we possibly can. So we cherish the opportunity to be women only, but obviously we're very fortunate that we are complemented by a men's team that many times is either working side by side with us. But again, we train totally independent of our men's team. So you know, we don't even talk about workouts all that often between coaching staffs. So, you know, we do our thing, you do your thing. We respect what you do and vice versa. And then we collaborate on home meets and you know, travel to various, you know, competitions. In fact, Coach Mack started a long time ago. We don't stay at the same hotel. He always felt that women were detrimental to focus for a men's team, which we found out is probably the exact reverse. But so the men always stayed at a different hotel, and then we would see each other obviously at the meet itself, and then cheer for each other accordingly. And the number of marriages that have evolved from that relationship is staggering. So obviously the two teams get along really well.
So I'm also curious, you talked about earlier, you know, signing a great freshman class, and obviously over the years you've had some incredible classes of young ladies come in and compete for cross country. I'm just curious, because, you know, most of these girls are head of the class coming out. How do you rein in that many personalities coming in at one time, you know, trying to just blaze from the beginning?
Yeah. Well, when I first did it, 1 year I had Sarah Schwall, Dina Drossen, who became Dina Drossen Castor, obviously, Nicole Teeter in the same class. And I learned there, I had three queens and no princesses. And then Megan Flowers transferred soon from Villanova. So now I got another queen. And so that was a very trying time, to say the least. The group that I have now and the culture that we've been able to create, there's not really a pecking order. And we talk about that often is, yeah, there are some people that are very dominant racers and do a fantastic job. But on any given workout, any given day, anybody in our collective group could be the leader that day. And so we try to make sure we encourage that as much as possible. And I had two transfers come in January of last year, just prior to COVID. And we, you know, ran our indoor season. They were both yanked off the track in Albuquerque with the rest of the crew as we headed home. So I brought them in soon after we returned, and I said, hey, I just want to let you know, even though we got robbed of the opportunity to possibly win a national championship as well as have you two, you know, contribute to that, I just was really impressed how both of you jumped in and improved so quickly and contributed to to the overall program, because your credentials prior didn't kind of indicate that. And they both looked at each other, and then they looked at me and kind of thought, man, I was, you know, talking in Chinese or something. And they said, you don't get it, do you? And I'm like, what are we talking about here? And they said, when you come here, the culture is you fit in and you just jump in and join the ranks and, you know, take care of business, and you do everything you possibly can to provide every ounce of support that is available and legal to give. And let's all strive to be the best we possibly can. And it was a great compliment, and I, you know, I use that now to sell other athletes that, hey, this culture, they're all here to support you to get better. And I think across the board, even though some may struggle to run 5:10 in the mile, there's others that are running, you know, 4:30 flat in the mile, but they're all cheering for each other.
It seems like then every single championship you have, you know, whether it be the SEC championship or national championship, it really seems the way that you portray that each kid, no matter where it is, the grad transfer that comes in for a quick semester or, you know, for the year, of course, you normally, it's a jigsaw puzzle. That's what each one, each piece definitely is. And you've got to make sure that thing fits correctly. I mean, to hear you talk about that, that's an incredible thing that, yeah, over 30 years you built, but at the same time, the girls, boom, boom, boom. And sometimes you get focused on what you have to do as the head coach, director. You don't have to worry about that much. They let that thing rock and roll.
It becomes kind of a self-providing prophecy. You know, it fulfills itself. And a lot of our senior leadership just does a fantastic job of kind of teaching the young ones what their expectations are and so on. And then the results are shared equally.
Well, Coach, you've obviously had a lot of successes. I got to ask, you know, I think as all of us know, with those successes come failures. Are there any failures that you've learned lessons from throughout your career?
There's no doubt about it. One of them, when it comes to the team aspect, you use the analogy of pieces of the puzzle. Sometimes one of those pieces just doesn't fit. And it's probably best that to get the ultimate picture of clarity that you're looking and desiring, is we encourage that one odd piece that maybe be best for them to look at another opportunity. And we've had to do that at times. When I first came, you know, obviously things went really well at Cal Poly. When I got to Arkansas, there was just lots and lots of expectations, obviously with the men just being so dominant that you put the women's uniform on and it says Arkansas, you should automatically win. Don't let expectations by others dictate success. You know, we got second at the national championships a few times in cross country. And unfortunately, at the time, the men won, so you became immediately overshadowed. And so the media kind of does that. And you just can't control it. So what I keep trying to convey to our kids, control what you can control, and don't worry about the, you know, the sidelights, because you can't do anything about it anyway, and it's just a waste of energy. So and I think they, for the most part, take that to heart. You know, right now the success, you know, the last 19 SEC championships, we've won 18 of them. What a lot of people don't understand is the year we chose to not try to win it was a year that I was trying to protect a few athletes, ultimately for the national championship. And so either they did not compete or they competed very selectively. And that was a decision made by the coaching staff. and we went in and did the best we could, considering that we were curtailing ourselves a little bit, ultimately to take advantage of the opportunity at the national championships. So I think one of the things we try to convey to our athletes, we're doing everything we possibly can for you as an individual to be as successful as you possibly can be.
So if I can, for the fun of it, we asked this question a little bit. I think we could go on that stuff for hours. I think we could do five podcasts, honestly. I'm just going at it again and again, and it is incredible stuff. So please don't take it wrong. So somebody who's been around, who's had the success that you have, here's where I kind of want to go with this. We've talked a lot about in this podcast, and our listeners have heard us talk about this, especially in today's world with COVID and the way things are going on. The future of track and field, the future of cross country itself, it's something that, heck, you and I, we've been to the convention, we've had conversations before the convention, we attempt to change things, and then people just kind of shit on it, and they don't get changed, and then no, okay, you know, that's the way things go. Is there something, is there a way, is there a meet, is there a format you'd like to see us go back to in track and field? And is that the SEC, I think, coaches in general, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've always been very vocal on, hey, let's get very, let's get out there and get seen. Let's get to ESPN. Let's get seen. Let's get ourselves on TV, that kind of stuff. When if you go to a school like UAB, the only thing we have against Arkansas is the fact that we've got maybe a better track and field facility than you do. And that's it. But it's apples and oranges. And what it is, you guys have an incredible facility. So don't take that the wrong way, please. But, you know, how do we move our sport forward? Should we change we've talked about changing the schedule. We've talked about going to dual meets, tri meets, that kind of stuff. So it's something that, yeah, your SID, your media can sit down and say, boom, UAB, Nevada, and Arkansas got in a dual meet. Nevada was second, Arkansas won, UAB third, but at least you have a winner and a loser. Like, right. What would you like to see done in track and field, even cross country for that matter?
Well, I think one thing that really is where it starts is with us as coaches. We need to all get on the same page. And we're so competitive and we're so factionalized, either to be pure cross country or pure sprint and so on and so forth, that, you know, we all have our differences. But I think when we try to appeal ultimately to the people that make the big decisions, the higher pay grades, they're looking at, you know, what do you bring to the table? And, you know, are you capable of being financially solvent? And I think one of the things that, you know, I've been to the Football National Convention. My wife was a former associate athletic director. They don't talk about how to cut each other to shreds. They talk about how to stay united. And then where we're talking about uniforms fitting a certain way, they're talking about, should we be getting three courtesy cars or, you know, four courtesy cars, or should they include insurance and gas and oil, you know, or are they buying my house to help cut down my, you know, my monthly rent check? There's so much more progressive in trying to rise everyone versus us trying to cut each other to make sure somebody doesn't get, you know, the proverbial head start or an advantage. So I think the unity factor is really, really important. And then if we can unify and standardize to some degree, we can help make ourselves more marketable, so that maybe a national sponsor is available. Heavens, USA Track and Field struggles, and we're offering the Olympic team to them. And, you know, they're having a hard time either getting a sponsor or retaining the sponsorship. So as collegiate coaches, you know, I think sometimes the NCAA gets in the way. But if we can sell TV, I mean, you know, you look at the standard TV shows these days where people are jumping through hoops and, you know, doing, you know, yard games and getting sponsorship for it. I certainly think we have a better product. And no matter where you are, if you're at a school as a have or a have not, we all have great stories to tell, because track and field athletes, they're usually great students. eventually become, you know, great leaders of our societies and so on. Not that TV particularly likes to give out, you know, praise and so on. It's much easier to, you know, find some, you know, lawbreaker or some other type of societal setback. I think if we can collectively tell those stories somehow, you know, we can make great headway. And I know our association, our coaches association, has made huge strides. When I first came into coaching, there was no such thing as a convention, you know? It was the idea of two or three coaches meeting on the sidelines as your teams are warming up. You know, eventually USA Track and Field started having summit clinics where people that were having some success, or there was physiologists and so on. I was very fortunate when the Glasnost exchange occurred. I could sit down with the Russian sports scientists and talk to them about drugs or certain types of training, or, you know, was bee pollen the way to go, you know, with the, you know, the honey aspect and, you know, the research they did on the common cold, so on. It was absolutely mind-boggling how much they had done year in and year out. And when they asked us what we had to offer, it was, well, we try really hard and we have a high school system, and then, you know, those that are fortunate move on to college. And I remember one of them just kind of giggling, going, so when they turn from 18 to 22, 24, you let them go wherever they want? It was like, yeah, that's the college system. That's democracy. You guys are fools. You should mandate where your talent goes to school. So, and again, I think a lot of us that, you know, we're at the Cal Poly SLOs or UABs or whatever, that don't have the gigantic budgets, still have a great story to tell.
That's one of the things. Would you suggest, I mean, for a lot of us, I do my best to get in touch with at least our sport administrator and our AD, talk to them a little bit about it. Would you tell college coaches, hey, not only, actually, yeah, go talk to your sport administrator, make yourself visible. Because I think one thing that coaches are very scared of, distance coaches are very scared in general, I think, because we're just doing it. But like, we don't want to be seen. We'd rather be sitting in the back row instead of being in the front row of the class. Let's go back to something you said earlier. Instead of being in the front row of the class, we want to be in the back row of the class. And it seems right. Like administration, especially in COVID, you've got to be in the front row of the class.
Yes. Out of sight, out of mind probably works if you're in the calculus class and you're not doing well. Yep. But as a coach, you need that recognition by the people that make the decisions, because if you are out of mind when they're passing out the bucks, you're probably not going to get a share that you would hope for. And, you know, we can bitch and complain, and track and field coaches are really good at that.
Very much so.
I think the idea is if we can unify or continue to unify and do these things like we're doing now in podcasts, it's invaluable to exchange, you know, what works at certain programs might not work at mine, but maybe 5% of it could work. You know, we're always, when I do a presentation, I always talk about my philosophy is basically aesthetic, because I've stolen from so many people, I can't remember all the people I stole from. And then I adapt it to, you know, my vocabulary and jargon, and then I call it my own. But, you know, there's been bits and pieces of a lot of famous people out there that, you know, contributed to the success that I have. And I think those of us that have been in the business a long time, we owe it to you and the younger generation to share those experiences. You know, I remember talking to one of the Russians and said, hey, is it true that, you know, bee pollen can really be successful in helping endurance. And they said, did a lot of research. Unless you have an opportunity to go to a certain valley in the Himalayas in a certain time in spring, the rest of it is all just junk. It doesn't work. And so rather than us having to experiment with, hey, there's 10 times 400 with a minute rest, is that the secret? Well, a lot of us can help those newcomers go, yeah, if you do it a certain way, this is how it can be even more effective. And I think that we can help that learning curve be more perpendicular than a sine wave.
So what, I'm going to ask a generic question here because I think it's there. I remember sleeping on the couch. I remember Scott Williamson getting my first job, and I remember sleeping essentially on a couch itself and in my office for a little bit. And it wasn't because he wasn't a good guy. He's a phenomenal gentleman, but we didn't have a lot of stuff. What would you tell that young generation that's trying to get into coaching going, hey, you know what? Stick with it. Or, hey, this is what you're going to run into. Or, hey, here's what it is. Because a lot of coaches nowadays, again, we don't find coaches like yourself that had the PE background and did that kind of stuff and actually taught at San Luis Obispo, you know, and did that stuff. Like, a lot of us are centrally focused on the distances, the jumps, the throws. Man, unless you're a multi, that can do two or three things, or the sprints coach and stuff. What would you tell the young coach? Like, hey, this is what you need to do to get in. Or here's the best way to help educate yourself.
Well, I think there's a lot of people out there that think there's a shortcut to how to get to one of the major jobs. There are no shortcuts. Everybody has to pay their dues. And it might require you for a year sleeping on a cot or living with pork and beans. You know, a great story with Dave Cinelli, when he volunteered to come on board and didn't have a job at the time to help pay. He used to go to a pizza parlor and order a drink, which was at the time 79 cents, sit down and then wait for people to get up from their pizza. And if there was leftover sections, that was dinner at the night. So, you know, he was, you know, paying his dues to the max to make things happen. And he lived in our track shed for a while, and then he got an upgrade. And he moved into a mobile home with two other guys. And it wasn't a mobile home. It was a travel trailer. And so it was rough. And but, you know, he loved the sport so much, and his passion and desire was just unending. And the result, worked his way as an assistant coach and then became a director of track and field at Virginia Tech, and has done a fantastic job since he's been there. So there's never any doubt that, hey, there's no shortcuts. It's a matter of, you know, paying your dues, learning as much as you possibly can. If you can diversify, make sure that much more marketable. You know, unfortunately, in this day and age, everybody thinks they can coach the distances. And that is probably the most inaccurate statement there is. But you can coach another event as well. I've been fortunate. The only event that I haven't had an All-American in is the Hammer. And so I've had to coach across the board one time or another.
That's pretty incredible. I mean, I remember my college coach, and you know, he's a head coach for Scott as well. He coached Iowa's first ever Big Ten throws champion, believe it or not. Yep. And so it was like, I mean, that's how we got into it. I mean, he was in high school from – I think it was a Lincoln Way or Parkway, one of the two. I can't remember. He'd probably yell at me if I couldn't remember that thing. But
Gospabala, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, you're right, actually.
Yep. I've heard that story many a time. So I that name, he, like I said, he'd kill us if we couldn't remember the name. So I'm pretty sure that's who it was.
Oh, yeah. No questions about it. But it's amazing how that was how it was. You had to be able to coach you may have been specialized in the jumps, but you had to coach the distances. And a lot of those great coaches, even then, you know, the ones in Indiana State and some others they all were able to coach the high jump while they're doing the distance events or something along those lines. That's just what they did. It was something that, again, it's a lost art right now. No questions about that.
Can I add something in here? Just from experience, then, Matt's first coaching job at Nicholls State in Louisiana, when he blew out, he went to Butler spring semester, and he came on and he was supposed to be doing track stuff and running. And the guy that was the head coach had his, anyway, he had a second assistant, Matt came, or first assistant, Matt came in as a second assistant. And the one thing that Matt did was, okay, I need to help out. So he learned the throws, the shot put, the discus, and coached those guys. And they had a pretty doggone good spring semester. But you talk about living in, you know, pork and beans or sleeping here, sleeping there. I mean, that was one of the most. And then he turns around and gets married in July.
Sometimes we all do some crazy so, things.
You know, like you were saying, yeah. Coach, talking about your past and the things that you give up to do things because you love the sport, you know where you're going, and that's this guy right here, and I'm very proud of him. So that's my two cents.
Yeah, and that's a nice compliment from any dad. You know, we all pay our dues, and we all want to contribute to society in a positive way, and one of the blessings we have in coaching. Brooks Johnson told me a long time ago, he goes, man, it's great to have a job as a coach because you don't have a real job. You just are so busy enjoying your passion. That
doing you what you love.
Get paid to do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I've got a question, maybe kind of a loaded question, but what makes you tick? What makes you tick, and how do you find balance in all that you're doing?
Good job, Arthur.
That's a great question. I'm very fortunate that I have good health, and I absolutely love what I do. So when I get up in the morning, I'm looking forward, if I have slept the night before, because a lot of times as coaches, we're, you know, just looking at this fan and watching it go around and thinking about this kid or that kid or whatever. But if I did have a good night's sleep, I really look forward to going to work in the morning and, you know, dealing with the challenges at hand. The bureaucracy of the NCAA and all the paperwork and such is getting a little bit old, but, you know, the kids are the ones that energize you, and you really look forward to it. As far as balance goes, you know, you got to have downtime one way or another. Coach Mack had a farm. He was a big time rancher. In fact, I've told many of people he might have been a better rancher than a track coach, which is really saying something.
Yeah.
His last ranch was 2,600 acres, and you know, he had three full time people that helped take care of it, but he was there all the time. And he just did a fantastic job of building this ranch. I mean, he started out at 10 acres and worked his way up. So eventually I bought 10 acres, but I think I'm going to run out of time before I can, you know, get to 12 acres. I don't think it'll ever happen. So, but the idea is that, you know, that's kind of a stress reliever. And then family is really, really important. And, I've been very blessed to have three children of my own, and then I married into a combined family of five children, and it has been a fantastic reward to have those children and be part of their lives. And as coaches, we miss a lot, and as I tell them, I really appreciate them because the amount of time I've devoted to taking care of other people's kids has been at the sacrifice of my own. And, you know, being away, you know, my average non-COVID year, I'm in the airplane with American Airlines because they're very good about monitoring my mileage. I average about 125,000 miles a year in their airplanes. And I think Marriott Hotels, one year, I spent 163 nights, in Marriott hotels. So, I'm away a lot from my family, and, you know, it is sacrificed, you know, a marriage, but I've been blessed that my wife right now is very tolerant and actually I think enjoys me being away.
Probably.
The COVID aspect has been testing her patience, but you know, balance is imperative. It's very, very important to always keep things in perspective.
Well, yeah, I always thought, you know, I've just been around you the last few years, and just to see the support of your family out at meets, out when you guys are doing stuff, hanging out at the hotel, like, to me, that's just awesome.
Well, I try to have each one of my children has either been at Olympics or World Championships, so they get an appreciation of what we're so giddy about, trying to get to that level and sharing that experience. You know, my daughter walking through the warm-up track, holding hands with Bolt as he gets ready to set the world record, is a picture in my memory that I'll never forget. And, you know, my son being at the Olympics with me in 92, when he had the opportunity to go to the basketball game with the Dream Team and play in Spain in Barcelona, and after the game get invited to go to dinner with Michael Jordan and his family. You know, those experiences are going to be cherished for life, and they came through the world of track and field. And so I'm truly blessed that the sport has given me opportunities that I never dreamed possible, let alone the opportunity to go to college initially. My first job, I made $13,160 for the year. I was coaching and teaching. And I called home and was ecstatic and told my dad, and my dad said, "Congratulations, you made more money than I've ever made in my life." So, you know, obviously it's elevated from there, but it's the idea that it was a starting point, and, you know, we continue to grow. And I think all of us, no matter where we are, if we continue to grow, you know, count your blessings every day.
Absolutely. No questions about that. Coach, I truly appreciate you taking the time. I know you got a busy schedule. I know you do a heck of a lot. You're always very generous in what you do. No questions about that, from speaking to clinics to everything in between. So thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. My pleasure.
Like you said, there's a lot of things to talk about. And if we ever want to do another one of these, we can start talking about experiences, you know, getting to deal with some of the great coaches and mentors that I've had that are great stories for each and every one of us. So love sharing that type of you know, what track and field can give back to all of us.
Absolutely. And we love to. I think we got a Tanja Buford Baylor we've got to do another one of, and we'll actually throw you on there's on another podcast.
Love it. It would be great. So, you didn't fail. It was fun.
I'm glad. Thank you, Coach. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the table of the meeting of the Unknowing Minds. Thank you for pulling a chair up to the table. We truly appreciate you sitting back listening to us. If you found value in this podcast, please go ahead and share it. Word of mouth, without question, is the most valuable media tool that we have. So please go ahead and share this. Tell your friends, tell family, whoever it is. Please go ahead and let them know what we just got done doing and just talking about. It is something that we take a lot of pride in, making sure that we are good to go. But as always, gentlemen, we look forward to making this happen again next week. And ladies and gentlemen, we're trying to. Thank you. Appreciate it.
He left.
All right. Thanks. Listen.